My name is Sue Collis, and I'm involved with an organization called Midwinter Harvest Food Program. Our organization and the community of Tyendinaga, on which we're based, have come to be known for our ability to provide large amounts of healthy food when it's needed. And that's essentially, in a nutshell, a lot of what Midwinter Harvest is about, that is the provision of like good, nutritionally sound, culturally appropriate food to First Nations people, to poor people, and to homeless people. We run mostly out of the Mohawk community of Tyendinaga near Belleville. Mm-hmm. I guess part of our mandate is not to strictly limit the food that we provide or the projects that we do to this community, but to extend beyond. So whether that be Kingston, Toronto, Gunnisadawgay, Six Nations, it doesn't really matter. To other Aboriginal communities, yeah, Mohawk and other Aboriginal communities generally, and also to just general city centers. We have in the time, I mean, we really started preparing the food, I think, in about 1997. Now, at that time, there was no name attached to it. That sort of all sort of come together more recently. But, you know, throughout the whole time frame, there's been thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of, be it fish, venison, ducks, vegetables, that have lined the tables prior to demonstrations, to actions, have been unloaded off the back of pickup trucks in some of Toronto's poorest housing projects, have, you know, just randomly gone to different places, First Nations School in Toronto, or for a homeless meal, you know, in Kingston, Belleville. It's fairly widespread. Midwinter Harvest sees the provision of food, the preparation, the distribution of food, not as a charitable act, which I think is a very common thing. And I think that the ability to provide large amounts of food in and of itself is significant, when so often people's experiences at food banks, either they can't access the food, or when they do, it can often be like a humiliating or degrading experience by the way that some of those places are run. So I think that we first of all deal with that we provide the food in a respectful and a dignified way, that there's no application processes, you don't have to prove that you need it, I mean, that kind of thing. But beyond that, we also see that there is a political aspect to all this that often gets lost, and that being that if you take a look at basically any social or resistance movement that has had any real degree of success in having an impact on the governing systems or the systems that oppress them, has an ability to deal with the basic needs of those oppressed populations in a very direct and tangible way. So that's a lot of, we actively go out and seek, well, obviously within the Mohawk Nation, there's no shortage of instances of struggle and resistance there, but we also actively go out and seek those other organizations that would be, you know, dealing with their own issues, be it housing and homelessness or whatever, so that we're able to assist them and provide something that can serve at least to a degree to alleviate some of the burden that poor people deal with on a daily basis. And I think that that does two things. One, it does do something to alleviate that burden, but it also demonstrates in the clearest of ways that the organization does more than just talk, and it serves once again to reinforce what those organizations are saying in terms of opposing, confronting, challenging a system of government or governments that for, you know, long since abdicated any and all responsibility, real responsibility in terms of housing and feeding and clothing people. And I think too, I mean, it's a funny thing too when you're dealing with organizing or resistance within Aboriginal communities. It happens a great deal more, I don't know if the word would be organically, but naturally. And there isn't very often organizations that are attached to it. It's just the nature of people struggling every day in their lives, right? And So we felt that by actually forming something into a more cohesive organization, and even just the simple fact of giving something a name that people can recognize, it provided a more readily accessible way for non-Native people to be involved, and I think really served to create something of a bridge that between the different resistance movements that isn't always there and isn't always just isn't always that easy for people to form those instances of solidarity. So I think that that's part of it, certainly. And a lot of the stuff that Midwinter Harvest would concentrate within the community of Tainanega would be around a lot of the language and culture, and providing an infrastructure where that, you know, can flourish. And, you know, that's I guess, sort of our own affairs. But then we would also seek to develop those relationships with other organizations and you know, outside of the community as well.
Is there this type of program anywhere else that you know of? Are there other organizations and groups of people that are, like, distributing culturally appropriate food?
I don't really know. I mean, I think a lot of times that it would just happen more just in a very natural way, where you know, when people are hunting and you know, come home, that the effort is made to ensure that some of that food does get to families that would otherwise not have it, you know, who wouldn't have a hunter or simply couldn't access it themselves. But I think that the emphasis on creating a larger scale infrastructure to deal with things, so like buildings where the food can be processed, where the community can meet and gather and talk about, you know, wider political issues. I don't know that exists to any major degree in a lot of the other communities as it stands right now. I mean, there's a real and here too at this point problem in that, you know, if you want to have a community meeting, or if you want you know, if you're looking to gather a large number of people, you inevitably are dealing with a situation where there's essentially nothing that is accessible without going through the band council, without paying for it, which obviously is a major impediment. So the notion of having a building, this summer we're building the Harvest House, which will allow for just those natural processes to occur. I mean, it sounds kind of ridiculously simple, but in fact, it's not. Decades, actually, that people have been looking for this type of building, but actually the gathering of the materials and, you know, putting everything together started for this particular building started about 5 years ago. And within that time frame, there's been, you know, people from the community ranging in age from 11 to 65 who've been involved in various aspects of the planning, the actual construction, you know, getting things ready. And then in addition to that, we have put out sort of an open invitation and encouraged, you know, other people from other places who, you know, are willing to give of their time and who recognize it as like an important endeavor to come and essentially participate in work days or work weekends. And it's been a really, I think, a really great kind of addition to the whole experience.
So people from all over are invited to come on down and pitch a hand.
Yeah, and have been since, well, we had the groundbreaking ceremony for the building, for the Harvest House in nearing the end of July this summer, and there was probably, 100-150 people who came from elsewhere just to sort of, I guess, share in the day and what, you know, is such an important thing for this community. And since that time, there's the real work has begun, and there's been a number of people that have participated from Ottawa, Toronto, Kingston, and Montreal as well. Ultimately, the needs that it's going to serve, one is the food storage, processing, and distribution center, so mm-hmm. that which is significant in and of itself. Right now, when people hunt, there's nowhere on the territory to actually have the animals processed. So either you're doing it outside, you know, in minus 15 degree weather with your knuckles freezing, or you're forced to take it to a business off reserve. And the thing about the processing of venison is that it doesn't, well, a lot of people would be very critical of the standards, the beef standards that exist, but in that they're not, you know, strict enough or stringent enough. But in fact, when you're dealing with venison, there are no standards. There is nothing that exists. So you end up with these little places literally right off the reserve that are just hopelessly unsanitary, totally disgusting. And people, when they take their stuff there, it's like exorbitantly priced, and it's not uncommon to lose very choice cuts of meat. So, yeah. So, and that is, you know, even in the time that we have, you know, put on the different meals and distributed the meat, it has largely been at personal cost to the families involved in the organization. So the ability to have some place on the territory deals with all of that and will greatly increase our capacity to distribute. And it will also, you know, help out many families. There's a lot of families who still rely on the venison and the fish as major staples in their household during the hunting seasons, eh? So that's one building. And then, as I've said, we're looking for another, just really to serve essentially as a community meeting center, like a center for the community where, you know, you don't have to pay or to, you know, have your meeting rubber stamped to be able to hold it. And then finally, as I said, there's a lot of emphasis that, you know, will be put around the culture and the language when, for instance, the parent-teacher association at the current school puts out surveys about what, you know, what is of greatest concern to the families on the territory. Time and time again, what will come back is the people's number one area of interest and concern, and what they want developed for their children is language and culture. And they want it further integrated into the curriculum. They want it, you know, the people want an immersion school here, mm-hmm. which doesn't currently exist. And those kinds of needs and wants that people have expressed are simply not being met, and they haven't been met over a number of years. So with having a structure, you know, our own structure, that, you know, Indian Affairs doesn't have a hand in, that the Band Council doesn't have a hand in, I believe that those kinds of programs can properly develop and that people's needs will be met. right now, our school is run by Indian Affairs. And I mean, there's internal sort of politics to that whole equation as well, in that Tynanega is one of the only reserves that school is still run by Indian Affairs, mm-hmm. Whereas most other communities have taken essentially buyout packages where Indian Affairs washes their hands of any of the financing for the education, and the band then assumes it. But what Tynanega has, I think most people agree, rightfully said, is that the financial package that Indian Affairs is prepared to put on the table just doesn't meet the need, and that it cannot actually address like the educational needs in the coming years, kind of thing. So Tynanega has refused to take it. But then what has happened is you have then this dynamic where anytime the community wants something implemented at the school, whether it be something as simple as classroom hours or who gets hired, or something, you know, more significant like an immersion program and, you know, language program, you end up in a situation where Indian Affairs very often comes back and says, well, you know, we'd really like to support you. Unfortunately, we can't. But of course, if the community was willing or prepared to take over the education, then you could do it yourselves. So it's this, I don't know, like loggerhead that just doesn't seem to, it just doesn't seem to end. And it needs to be dealt with. And a second, like a different facility, like we're able to, you know, hopefully put up under Midwinter Harvest, can circumvent that whole problem.
Well, and this seems to speak to this situation I've heard called dual power, where a non-governmental organization arises that meets the needs of people and begins to accumulate substantial following and fulfills a basic need of a community to a point that it begins to effectively compete with the existing structure.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky situation, but I think that we would, as an organization, believe that, you know, I mean, in terms of financial management or, you know, those kinds of things, like, for sure, we would certainly not disagree with the fact that needs to happen, but that any sort of other, be it political or social decision that affects the community and community members, is something that should be decided by community members. And you know, how exactly Midwinter Harvest develops and takes shape remains to be seen. But I mean, ultimately, that would be what, you know, the direction that we would be wanting to go in.
And what kind of administration is there going to be for the whole program?
Well, I mean, that, again, I mean, that, I think, ultimately goes back to what the community wants and the willingness of people, and to what extent that people are going to be prepared to participate. Because, you know, within the Mohawk Nation, it's not a situation where anything has to be reinvented. I mean, it all exists. It's readily, you know, it's accessible, it's there, very comprehensively so. And it's just a matter, a lot of people say, just a matter of becoming the people that our ancestors once were. I mean, that's sort of the line. And you know, hopefully this will just be one sort of aid in getting there.